And if you're one of the seller and you've got a $4 to $20 million practice, whatever you've got, and you want to partner with us in the acquisition of another practice, we have a way for you to participate in that without any capital, but we just value your leadership. And leadership is that intangible it factor that the doctors have that have already built great practices and want to take it to the next level. For the practice owner who doesn't want to continue, it's it factor leadership characteristics and be responsible for it. We're not the candidate because we really want doctors that want to leverage inequity with us.
Hey there, dental economist. If you're a dentist owner or a leader within a dental business thinking about growing production, case acceptance, patient and staff satisfaction, positive outcomes, and everything else that comes with running a dental business, then you're a dental economist and you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Dental Economist Show. We're meeting at the intersection of profit and purpose as I sit down with dental leaders who share their stories about dentistry, business, and growth. Welcome back to another episode of the Dental Economist Show. I'm your host, Mike Huffaker. On this episode, I'm joined by Carrie Strain, President and CEO of Strain Dental Management. Carrie and his organization have touched every segment of the dental industry over the past 30 years, creating communication and management protocols, policies, and systems that have become industry standard. In April of 2022, Carrie and his wife, Olivia, founded a new DSO under the Strain Dental Management brand. Strain Dental Management was recently named a 2024 Emerging DSO to Watch by Group Dentistry Now, and in just under 2 years has grown to support over 39 practice owners. Carrie is known as the Data Whisperer, where analytics are his guiding principle behind his DSOs. His dental consulting team works with over 280 practices on a daily basis. Carrie, welcome to the podcast.
Mike, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So I want to jump right into the fact that you have run a consulting organization, consulting with thousands of practices over the years. And a few years ago, you decided to start your own DSO. Tell me a little bit about what went into making that decision.
And that's the $64 question. I have had a great career in dentistry. You know, I started out my career working with my dad and my brother, Harry, Larry, and Carrie, in a public accounting firm. So we owned that business. And my dad retired in 87. My brother died in 89, June 27th. Not that I went looking for dentistry because of that, but some of my initial accounting clients who did accounting and tax work were dentists. They asked me to help them grow their business. And I told them initially I didn't know how. A CPA or tax accountant understands how to prepare tax returns and financial statements, but they don't know the difference between a profi and a tootsie roll necessarily. And I had to learn. And I started working with one, and it led to two, and it led to 100, led to 200, led to 1,000. And as I continued to grow in the early 90s, I asked myself, who's got the opportunity to partner with and figure out how to be a support to them so we could both grow our businesses? And I started with Patterson Dental accidentally in Sacramento, California, with the manager there at the time. I met a sales rep. One day he referred me to seven dentists. I thought I'd found the goose that laid the golden egg. Worked with them throughout the state in the early 90s. And by the middle of the decade, the CEO had asked me to work with them nationally. We did that. The VP of marketing that I worked with closely left that company, went to work for a bigger company called Henry Schein, or at the time Sullivan Schein. And we were invited to be a part of their organization as an alliance partner. And we grew accordingly, working between 2001 and 2018. In 2016, when I turned 60, I'll be 68 next month, my wife and I were talking about what we're going to do in the final chapter. And I said, I've traveled. I get to do all that I want. I play golf at great country clubs. I have great friends in the business. And I said, I'm not ready to retire. And I said, more importantly, I've been mulling through the thought process of the DSO offerings and having represented in the pre-DSO world, they were group practices, Mike. And one of my very prominent previous relationships was with Heartland Dental back in 1999 when the CEO, Dr. Workman, and his first cousin, Jeff Stacer, who was their founding CFO, met me in Scottsdale at the McCormick Ranch at a Dentsply event. Asked me to help them, and we worked with them for several years. And Pat Bauer had been hired by them, and so he's a great guy and is a CEO today and fantastic organization, really the trailblazers. In the years that followed, I met other private equity firms that had investments in the space, and they were concerned about their platform. So we'd get involved, and as we did with all of our clients, we'd put in the operational aspects in the practices, grow the practices, and working with the DSOs, helping them understand revenue enhancement opportunities, overhead management issues, and continue to grow. I'd sold the accounting firm in the early 90s. In 2016, having worked with thousands of practices, not motivated by the economics because we had already planned for our retirement, had our house of our dreams, country club of our dreams, all the things that would make our dreams come true. It was a gnawing thought in my head, thinking about all of my great clients. Because keep in mind, most of our consulting clients, they weren't low-performing practices. They were high-performing practices. Not uncommon to meet somebody who's doing $2, $4, $6, $8, $10 million a year in revenue. They have an appetite for accomplishment. So they ask, what's next? And if you don't understand the clinical, administrative, and economic and emotional aspects of your recommendation so that the culture can continue to be enhanced while you navigate through strategy, you're never going to be able to help them. So we did. And they became targets for acquisitions for the best solutions possible at the time, where the other DSOs coming in and offering them 5, 6, 7, 8 times, 9 times multiple of their EBITDA, when these doctors don't even know what EBITDA means or how it's calculated. Furthermore, most CPAs don't either. And they were targets. And they typically wouldn't get a lot of equity in the hold co on their offer. So if you had Dr. Mike practice and you're doing $1 million of EBITDA, maybe somebody was going to give you 7x, 4 in cash, 2, 2.5 in earnout or sub-DSO partnership percentages, and maybe a small sliver of equity up in the hold co, which is the only place it's valuable. There's no valuable consideration given for sub-DSO partnership levels unless it's convertible into equity. And earnouts are just a straight, flat, minimal payout. So I sat down and I had met an attorney that had worked with a lot of DSOs and my clients. And I called him and I said, here's what I want to do. I want to create a DSO where the doctor's on the bulk of the equity. I don't think I need private equity yet, but I think I'm hoping I can finance it with debt. And I called my old friend, Jeff Stacer, who had worked as the founding CFO for Heartland. He had retired from them in 05 and was just sitting on the sidelines coaching basketball. And I always talked to him throughout the years, maintained a contact. And I called him in 16, started to develop my business plan. And I had him and the attorney test the hypothesis of my business plan and gave me some guardrails on the highway as we accelerated. And then we presented it to the doctors. And I said, look, guys, the most you're going to get on a doctor-doctor sale is 60 to 80% of collections. That's in essence 3 to 3.5 times EBITDA. If you sell to a DSO, you might get a total earnout of 15 to 17 times EBITDA. And if you want 25 to 30 times, 35 times EBITDA on a total earnout, you're going to have to A, work for it. B, have an appetite for rolling equity. You're not going to harvest all the cash up front. And C, you need to be part of the leadership team that demonstrates that this business is a great place for investors to invest in. And if you'll do it with me, we want to change the industry and really create an environment or an entity where the doctors don't feel disenfranchised and they're part of the voice of supporting the patients and the team. So we met with a group of doctors in a focus group meeting on April 7th, 2017 in Sacramento. Met with 25 of them. I told them I needed 24 of them or I wasn't going to do the deal. I didn't need it. I could have gone and, you know, lived in Boise or Boston. It doesn't matter. And I live in the Bay Area. I live south of San Francisco, down on the Monterey Peninsula. I split my time between here and our corporate office in Sacramento. But what's exciting is we got enough doctors to want to pull the trigger. We got a little stalled during COVID, but after COVID, we did a Q of E on the operations. We went with our investment banker at Ernst & Young, and we secured a loan to fund the operations, fund our acquisition line, and we're super properly qualified in terms of financial stability. Our EBITDA and our practices are growing at record amounts or percentages because they're subscribing to the principles that I've taught for over 30 years in the strain management system, and they're leaning in and doing a great job. And we'll soon have 45 locations, and we have an acquisition target group moving into LOIs of around another $80 million in revenue. And our goal is to not put a ceiling on it, but we'll certainly go to market and recap in 2026. And we'll be looking for the right investor to partner with us. So that's how it happened. It was an accidental experience to become a consultant. And it was unintended to form a DSO. And I don't intend to flip our DSO off to anybody else because we really have a lot of pride in our history, our track record, and our ability to attract and retain quality doctors to be partners with us along the ride.
It's really interesting. There's the thought exercise that I think people kind of play when they're in high school or growing up. It's like, if you win the lottery, what would you actually do? The whole kind of premise behind it is if you change the financial incentive and you no longer feel like you need to do things for a specific reason that are directly related to financial outcomes, is there a passion that you would follow or something else, like if given that freedom? And within the construct of kind of what you've just shared, is you had the ability to take a step back and say, well, how would we do this if we didn't have to be constrained with maybe the more traditional desired outcomes from a financial perspective and just do things in the same way that they've been done before? And it gave you this freedom to take a different approach. How did you gather that first initial focus group? Were these consulting clients that you had worked with? What was the approach to sit down and present in that first initial meeting this new vision for how a group could look?
Always working with 300 to 400 active consulting clients with a great team of consultants and coaches, I was approached by a lot of our clients in this new century about the work we'd done at Heartland and the work we were doing with other private equity firms and the platforms they'd invested in, that we would step in. And we had a nickname called the secret weapon for a very prominent private equity group out there today that's been in the oral surgery, the endodontic, and the GP and the orthodontic space. And that's very flattering. And they all said, why don't you form your own DSO? Hey, wait a minute. That's like saying, why don't you open a separate business altogether? It's being a consultant is absolutely not the same as running a DSO. And sitting on a board of directors and being the chairman and being the CEO of the holding company and the DSO has with it a tremendous amount of responsibility that when it was just Livy and me in our business and we were making a few million dollars a year profit. I mean, I had a great business. It was easy. Consulting business is good, especially if you know how to scale it with the right partners, which we did. But those doctors kept coming to me. And so the ones that had come to me that had an interest in being committed, I told them, this isn't going to be a flip. It's not going to be a cash grab. I mean, if you want that, sell off to somebody else. You want to make a difference. I need to build a business plan, if we're going to do this, that creates a pathway to attract doctors for decades and beyond my lifetime. And I plan on living a long time. So there was an initial target group. I would say they were doing $2 million to $15 million a year in revenue. They were producing and collecting more than a buyer would want to finance and purchase. And the responsibilities for management were such that the typical acquisition group with the time was a couple of associates would buy out a very entrepreneurial primary founding doctor, and the associates would end up in a fight because neither one of them would put up the effort. They never were really trained, and it all crumbled in that second generation. It certainly never got to a third generation, and they too become targets for an acquisition for a low price. So it was that initial group. Then what I did after we had the initial pilot group, I brought them all in. And then Livy and I, my wife's name's Olivia, Livy and I were going on a vacation immediately after the focus group meeting. And I said, I'll be back the 1st of June. We went to Europe and with some friends and we had a good time for 3 weeks, came back and I said, okay, we're now going to have a series of biweekly webinars. And we invited all former Strain consulting clients. There were thousands of them. And if they wanted to respond and come and listen in to myself, to our attorney, Scott Crow, to Jeff Stacer, my colleague, who was a contractor to us at the time, we said, we're going to build this. It's going to be a multi-year commitment. We're going to launch the services component of our platform January 1, 2018. And then 2 years later, we should go to market. Well, 2 years later, it was COVID. So that stalled us for a year and a half. And then we went to market and it all transacted. By then, from an initial core group of around almost 60 practices that had signed up from the management platform, and they weren't paying much, but $5,000 a month with the intent to roll in and get cash and get rolling equity. We were down to 37, 38 total, and it was enough. We needed for us to go to market and secure the financing. We needed to make sure we had north of $15 million with EBITDA, or we couldn't get the attention of the lender. But we had a great investment banker. They got us a great lender. And with everything we're doing today, that 15, 16 million of EBITDA we were at, when we recap, we should be at 75 to 90 million of EBITDA.
So when you create a management structure like that, and when the dentist owners still retain such a significant portion of the equity in the business, I heard you on the Patient First podcast with Brian Lask, and I think you mentioned on average 85% equity in that holdco, as we were talking about, which is unusual. How are you structuring things where you avoid the too many cooks in the kitchen scenario and you are actually able to drive a strategic vision and ensure that you can create consistency in what matters to driving the value and creating a culture that is really the desired outcome?
Too many chefs spoil the broth. Everybody that got involved with this project, and even to the ones I met with earlier today, I mean, we're closing out a practice on the East Coast with 6 million of revenue and 1,154 of EBITDA and the doctor can't wait to be my partner. There's a lot of trust in what Jeff Stacer, our CFO, Livy, our COO of the consulting firm, Vera Powell, our director of operations, and I put together at the management platform. I didn't want to go to committee. I'm the one who created the vision. I'm the one who's committed to seeing it through. I think I'll retire in about 12 years when I turn 80. Maybe not then either. I don't want to assign the responsibility of another future CEO at this time, where we need to get through the point where we've gone through a recap. So it's pretty simple. We have a very fair agreement. They do own all the sellers who sold their practices and businesses into us on April 13th of last year, own 85% of the company today. That's unheard of, because the equity firm, or as one of my DSO founding clients of a large DSO said, they don't deserve the equity of the doctors in the platform. The platform creates the value. And I said, you know, these guys entrusted me and paid me a lot of money over the years to build models for them that couldn't be sold. Or if they were going to be sold, they'd be sold for peanuts. And then they'd have somebody sitting on the C-suite of XYZ DSO that attended a few weekend courses on how to grow a practice. We call a bumper sticker advisory. We're going to build a doctor-centric practice. They don't know what that means. They just say these things. They're a little slogan. We're going to build a hygiene-driven practice. They don't know the difference between a 4910, a 4381, a 4355, a 4361, 62, 66, 4346. Doesn't matter. They don't know all these things. They haven't lived in the weeds like we have. So our company right now has led by a great board of directors. And at this time, there's one vote and you're looking at it.
Very interesting. So I'm curious, when you talk about somebody else that says that the platform drives the value and you're creating an environment where there's a lot of trust, there's long-time relationships, it's a unique model and setup. What are the value drivers from your perspective?
The number one value driver is the doctor and the team and the continuity of leadership and the legacy there. I mean, these are men and women that I've had a working relationship with for years that are at the core of our initial targeted group of practices we acquired. They really leaned in and want to be a part of it. They believe that we can make a difference together, and they are responsible for delivering the growth in revenue and profitability that each of the other ones are responsible for. And if they aren't going to make that commitment, it's going to become apparent in a fall off on collections and profitability. And it's not easy today. There's a lot of downward pressure on revenue. There's downward pressure on reimbursement, and there's upward pressure on overhead, principally labor costs. And if you don't understand the levers to pull, you're going to make the wrong decision that's not going to stand the test of time. And that's why there's a lot of hurting DSOs right now that have been told, stop buying, cut your expenses. And they've got a finance committee stepping in because the covenants aren't being met in their loan or investor agreement. So you're seeing a lot of DSOs attempting to go to market that can't get any liftoff. Timing's one thing, but performance is another. So we have great partnerships. We're all aligned and their commitment is strong. We have an advisory committee that's both clinical and business. I have a meeting tonight. And then next Tuesday night, we have our monthly partner meeting. And we talk about where we are, where we want to be, initiatives we're rolling forward. And if we have a performance issue to address, we have an assigned consulting team member. That's really another distinctive feature of our platform, is that when I went to market, the investment banker and the lender got on the phone with me and they said, we just have one thing getting in the way of us providing you with $122.5 million. I said, what's that? And they go, you need to sell your consulting firm into the holding company as well. I said, why? Those are my cookies. And they said, because we don't want you to have a conflict of interest. And if you're chasing your consulting revenue instead of focusing on the growth of the group, you're going to be out of alignment. I said, done. Not a problem. Let's make it work. So Livy and I sold the consulting firm into the holding company. So our holding company, Strain DM Holdings, owns the consulting firm, which is Carrie Strain LLC, DBA Strain Consulting. And it also owns Strain Dental Management, the DSO. And we have another real estate company as well within all that. But we're all reporting up to all the common owners up in the whole company. Now, what's emerged over the last 12 months is a sub-DSO partnership that I probably talked about with Dr. Laskin in his webinar. And so today, meeting somebody young like you, 44, I recall, somebody your age comes on board. We want to acquire them. They have a great practice. They want to relief of some of the duties of being a business owner. They've grown an $8, $10, $12, $15 million business, maybe a $2 million business. They want to still be the lead partner, possibly be a working dentist. We can do that. We'll acquire anywhere between 51 to 75% of the EBITDA assignment from the EBITDA you own and form a sub-DSO. So in that case, there's three buckets of value that the doctor gets. He gets cash, he or she gets cash on the initial sale for that portion we're buying, a multiple. They get them stock in the whole company. What a way to leverage their equity, right? Right next to me. There's only one class of stock. So we're all together. And last, they still own a percentage of the right to the EBITDA in the sub DSO that we can buy later. But in the short term, I think of one of our partners up in South Dakota. He's going to be able to earn money as a dentist, according to our comp plan, and earnings from the joint venture to support his family until we go through the recap in 2026, where he gets another check. And if he decides to sell more of a percentage to us, that's fine. But in the meantime, he's supported by a world-class platform.
Yeah, so you're really creating a growth opportunity path for those that are maybe less established or don't have practices that are as large as the one that you just mentioned that you're closing on here recently.
And if you're one of the seller and you've got a $4 to $20 million, whatever you've got, and you want to partner with us in the acquisition of another practice, we have a way for you to participate in that without any capital, but we just value your leadership. And leadership is that intangible it factor that the doctors have that have already built great practices and want to take it to the next level. For the practice owner who doesn't want to continue its it factor leadership characteristics and be responsible for it, we're not the candidate because we really want doctors that want to leverage in equity with us, get some cash, but leverage in equity and be a part of the team that creates the most valuable DSO ever.
Has your growth been intentional where you've gone to seek out specific partnerships that you've been aware of after the initial 25? My understanding is you're up to 39 or above at this point, and that's happened, those additional 14 or 15, in a relatively short window of time. We're talking less than 2 years. It sounds like you have the ability to be selective in those that are entering into a partnership with you. How do you think about that? Is there like an ideal profile that you pursue? Has it come largely through word of mouth, through the existing network that you've created or those that you've already partnered with? And can you talk a little bit about that?
All of the above. I mean, we meet with practice brokers. We meet with people in the industry that they know somebody who might be a good fit for us, as well as get referrals from our partners, as well as our consulting business. Current and previous clients know where we are in this space. And when it comes to them thinking about their last 10 years, how do they want it to unfold? They can either take a $3 million practice and sell it to associates for maybe $1.5 million to $1.8 million, or they can leverage that up to $12, $13 million with me. You pick. And unfortunately, due to spending habits and lack of knowing how to invest money properly or how to even save it, 95% of dentists are not economically prepared for retirement. In light of that, this is a way to help fund that future, and they need to be a part of making it happen. And when I say economically prepared for retirement, I'll never forget one of my early wealth advisors said, whatever you're earning in your last 3 years of your career on an annual basis, on average, is what you're going to want to see as income when you go to retire. So you take a dentist who's a good net income earner of $1 million a year or $700,000 a year, they built a lifestyle to consume that amount of capital. And it's kind of hard to let go of that. So they don't make the decision to save. They don't save along the way. And when the time comes to partner with somebody like us, maybe they wait again and they're going to miss their windows of opportunities and eventually sell the practice for a song and park cars in the airport after that, because you're just not going to have any capital to live on. It'll be very disappointing. They can do some planning today. And the future of dentistry is platform supported practices, because it's just too doggone complex to run a business anymore. But if they can have an equity play in it and stick around and make that happen, we're just a great fit for them.
Yeah, it's a great call out. And I definitely don't think it's something that people put a whole lot of thought into. Most kind of retirement models are, well, what do you need in order to make ends meet versus to maintain where you're at the point of retirement? So it's a good call out.
Money's only a problem if you don't have enough of it. And in most cases, when you have a spending pattern of X and you want to cut it by 50%, there's a lot of disappointed people.
So I got to ask you, so I'm a software guy. I work for a software company. What part does software play in the platform as you build it? What do you think is important to mandate across as must-haves or must-dos? What are you more flexible on? Do you drive adoption of certain practice management? Is it more of an analytics play? Do you look to aggregate data on the back end? Talk me through your thoughts on how you can properly support to counter those, you know, headwinds and tailwinds that you're talking about, the pressure from above and below, and where software fits in that piece.
Software for the doctor, for an appetite for offering a robust suite of clinical services is an essential component. So from scanning for crown preps and scanning for any type of restorative and cosmetic work, to artificial intelligence to aid in treatment planning, second opinion, if you will, those are absolutely essential clinically today. You know, even for the last 30 years, we've had intraoral cameras, right? How basic is that? But yet they go unused every day. They sit in the corner. We have technology to talk about bone loss, and you only have 5% of the patients in perioral maintenance when the CDC says 74% of people over the age of 65 have periodontal disease. So there's a human element to it. It's got to come into play. But in terms of efficiency, I mean, I was on having a conversation with an administrator who was communicating to me. It was artificial intelligence, as if I was having a conversation. And so when it comes to executing a strategy, AI can lead you, whether it's analytics, you know, whether you've got Jarvis or Dental Intel and you're gathering data, you can eliminate the need for going to one practice management software. Although I think if you don't have the ability to aggregate information and have it centralized so that you can bring your experts to come up with a recommendation that can be disseminated out in the field and then monitor the execution, I think you're just at a weakness because you just can't find all the intellectual horsepower you need in people. So that you work in a decentralized fashion is not going to create predictable results for anybody. So I see the future. We're addressing it right now about getting to a common practice management platform. But in the meantime, we use Jarvis, we use Dental Intel, we gather data. We use it at the practice level. We use it in the strategy level. We use it for the accounting department so we can push out the financial statements. I just think that the growth in software's capability to help owners execute strategy and in some cases decide what strategy to pick, I think is becoming more and more at the forefront of opportunity for everybody. And I get excited about it. I was on the phone with a Conversant AI software company the other day, and I could pick the gender I want to talk to as a customer. I could pick the age of the person, the dialect of their communication, and I know what I'd pick, and I think, and that would make me feel comfortable, and it puts me in the state of receptiveness, and it overcomes having to train people on what to say. And when you have this conversation with this software, it's as if you're talking to your mother. You have to have the ability to understand what the priorities are in terms of committing to the investment of time and money, and then the pathway to get it done, and building the team around you to help your field team and the platform people get properly supported so they gain the skills necessary to capitalize on the investment.
There's a lot of good points that you made there. And I think if you look at, from the clinical perspective, all of the undiagnosed available treatments that take place, there's so many different opportunities to grow within an individual practice. And the model that a group decides to pursue absolutely plays a big piece in what their software stack should look like. So if you were looking to have regional managers, like you talked about Heartland before, of course, they have a consistent practice management across all of their offices because you don't want to train people over and over again to use different systems if you're going to be interacting with the same systems in different offices all the time. So there's workflow implications that can be considered and other things along those lines. I would be curious, when you think about the growth plans that you have for your organization, would there come a time where you could see yourself offering centralized services in the way of RCM or billing or AR collections services or even centralized scheduling? Do you think that that affects patient experience at all? And what is your perspective on that?
Well, certainly for revenue cycle management, I could see centralization as key. I mean, you know, I gave this seminar, and I know it sounds very basic. I gave this webinar last Friday for Dell Intel. Let's come back to the core basics. 100% of your patients should leave with their next appointment, principally their hygiene appointment at a minimum. Number two, if they have pending treatment, especially if they have a way to fund it with insurance, there's no reason it's not rescheduled. And number three, don't you want to collect your copayment? Now, if you're doing those things, you don't have to chase a lot of unscheduled people. The schedule should be full and you should have the money. Then all you're dealing with is the assignment of the benefit from the insurance company. And after so many days, if that claim not being paid, that becomes a patient bill as well, if you can make that happen. So we minimize all the debris that emerges in the wake of poorly trained personnel or undercommitted personnel. If that's the case, we're truly just managing the supply and demand component and how to leverage on inflection points when there are no more openings and we have more patients than we can see. Do we expand or do we move out of network and raise our fees? All different issues. So we can look at that and really make the right decisions that not only allow the practice to take care of the number of patients that they want to take care of, but have it fit economically. And in doing so, I mean, we just can't be giving out wage increases like we've seen since COVID started and not expect for revenue enhancement. That's where the advisors at DSOs have missed the boat. If you're looking at a 20% increase in wages from 20 to 24% of revenues, you've just eaten into your margin. And if you don't have the margin, you're not going to have the EBITDA that based on the loan covenant that causes you to meet the covenant, and then you're going to get shut down. Or you're going to want to go to recap, and the investor is going to say, I get my preferred rate of return. I get my money back before you get yours. And there isn't enough left over for you. So I can't go through this recap right now, because if the investors or the role in equity isn't getting what they want, the doctors, as my friends in the business say, your most valuable assets wear shoes. And it's more than just the doctors today. If you're not creating an absolute unbelievable economic opportunity for doctors, hygienists, assistants, and administrators, you miss a boat.
So what you just said, in order to remain consistent with those things that sound simple, like, hey, you got to have the next appointment scheduled. If there's an available benefit, why is that not taking place? In order to ensure that those types of things aren't slipping through the cracks, you're making data-driven decisions. You're making sure that the data is all front and center. Is that, from your perspective, just one of the biggest challenges that practices have, is the fact that they are not consistent in their application of looking at and analyzing data to ensure that they are following a consistent protocol at all times?
For a majority of the practices, yes. I mean, we've done over 20,000 consultations with dental practice over my 30 years. We offer a free strain practice analysis to anybody who wants to sit down and talk to us for an hour. What I found was practices were owed exceptional amounts of money, even though they had an expectation to collect the copayment, because nobody inspected what they expected, number one. Number two, of the active patient, we call it the patient flow litmus test. Of the active patient pool, the number of patients seen in the last 18 to 24 months, 48 to 52% of them were in hygiene, and of them, 70% rescheduled. Because the ultimate barometer a small business owner looks at, there's two, is my schedule full, and do I have enough money to keep drawing a paycheck? Even the owner thinks of that. And that's it. They're not thinking strategically. They don't have adequate amounts of working capital reserves. I mean, you need at least 1 month's collections in working capital reserve. Otherwise, you're going to be borrowing from the bank all your life. And the doctors don't have the patience, or their families don't, because they've trained them not to have, to experience a deferred gratification for all their hard work. I always say, do you know how to get $1 million in your bank? Work hard enough to make $2 million worth of profit, pay the tax, and not spend it. Have you ever seen the video of the marshmallow test?
I don't think I have, no.
They bring in these kids in, they say, here's a marshmallow, Mike. I'll be back in 5 minutes. And if you haven't touched a marshmallow, when I come back, I'm going to give you a second one. And they have a video on you. And you're sniffing the marshmallow. You're licking it. Sometimes you're eating the bottom out. So you can fake it later. And of course, you're not going to get the second marshmallow. When you're not investing in your business and working on your business, and you're only in it to the extent that you can make enough money to meet your current needs, you're never going to create a retirement. You just got a job.
So I think this might be also the answer to this last question I have for you. But what is something, you know, you've spoken to so many dental professionals over the years. What is something that you regularly are told is something that they wish that they were better educated about?
They always say, I wish I would have met you 20 years ago. Here's the fallacy. I'm not going to train somebody to think like me. They're going to have my mom and dad, their values, my older brother, my sister, they're going to have to live in my household, go to my college, get my job in the accounting world, be asked to advise people and never expect to make a penny from it, and be asked to work with the greatest supply companies in the history of dentistry, Patterson and Henry Schein, and the greatest DSO in the history of dentistry, Heartland Dental. And through the sum of those experiences at age 67 and 11 months today, have enough experience to draw from. So when I see a new set of data sets, I can apply it based on the context of my memory, whether you want to talk about outliers or blinks or talk about whatever book you've read. I talked about those books from Malcolm Gladwell they're great books. I mean, do you think I see this stuff because I grew up with Harry Strain? No, it's having consulted with so many practices and experienced the successes and failures of strategy along the way. And I've had more successes than failures, or I wouldn't be where I am. And we intend to continue to employ that commitment in the future, leading with patient care, team development, and that includes all the four components of administrators, assistants, hygienists, and doctors, and building a great management platform to support them And having doctors and equity firms want to be our partners in the years to come, because there's a place for both of them on the cap table.
That's great. Kerry, I really appreciate you joining. Thank you.
Mike, my pleasure. Thank you.
The Dental Economist Show is brought to you by Planet DDS. To find out more about how cloud-based dental software by Planet DDS helps unleash dentists and their staff to focus on patient care, visit www.planetdds.com. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes by following wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.